Steve Brown is joining me this morning. He has written a Simon Review book. I'm calling it a book, a paper, I guess. And it's called
a short book.
It is a short book. Exit Essay, a Reflection of More Than 50 Years of Media Coverage in the Illinois State House. And I told Steve, and I'll tell you before I went on the air, I read the entire thing last evening. I thought it was one of the best things I've read. And part of this is because I know you, and so that helps me a little bit with the content. But the frankness of the, and this is one of the parts I enjoy about you. You can be frank without being rude.
I try. Yeah, I mean, I hope I can do that. I mean, as I listen, you could raise questions without being insulting, without being an attack dog or anything.
Right.
And I've always thought that way, and I've been down here all week, Tom, and I've listened to your show almost every morning, almost from gavel to gavel, which is probably people listen to AM radio in their cars more than anywhere else anymore.
Right.
And so a couple of people have been on, if I had like the immediate call to station hotline number, I would have called and said, just tell me a little bit more about X, Y, or Z. But I would do it not to necessarily attack their point of view. I mean, everybody gets an opinion in the world I'd like to live in. And unfortunately, that's not always the case, but it could be.
Let's talk about this first, because you can't talk about Steve Brown in 50 years in media and State House and Chicago and media without talking about where it all began. And I found it interesting that you seem to define your youth and its growth by the time you spent in the offices of the Daily Egyptian newspaper.
Well, it certainly was the most, I think, vivid memory in terms of being at SIU Carbondale from 67, I graduated in 71, which, by the way, makes me eligible to be part of the 50th reunion.
It does.
Yeah, and so, and beyond all that stuff, the geezers, as I like to refer to us, we have a couple of special events. There's a brunch on Saturday, but anyway, I don't get to that. And I remember, I remember classes, I remember instructors I liked, but I remember the days where, as a student worker, I'd go over, work in the back shop, and I would be responsible for putting the little black lines between the classified ads, which is now done by computer typesetting, right? But and you did that with that little tape you used for doing pinstriping on model cars and an X-Acto knife, And on the good days, I had all the lines very exact and very straight. And some other days, it was a little wobbly, And then I would sneak into the newsroom a little bit toward the end of the day, off the clock, write a headline, maybe make a phone call, do a cut line for a picture, get somebody else a Coke. And then gradually I got myself, I think at the end of that, I was like the student editor when we still had a faculty managing editor that called the shots and was named the outstanding journalist of that 71.
You learned by watching, and you talk about this later. You didn't go to a PR class. You're a journalist.
Yeah.
And won awards for that, including the Jacob Shearer Investigative Report for exposing consumer fraud gambits against potential product inventors. But during this time of your life, early in life, we're talking about now, we've left SIU, you're working in Springfield in Chicago, and you're watching. And you say in your book, my observations tended to focus on how the news media might portray a proposal and how to make it an easily understandable story. I can tell you, Governor Bruce Rauner came to my home. It was the first thing he said when he came through the door. He asked me if I'd be interested in being a press secretary for him. I need somebody that can make these things understandable.
Right. Oh, and that's a huge problem, a huge challenge, because you'll be talking in the jargon and the nomenclature of
you particularly talk about acronyms.
Yeah, acronyms and okay, but what does that mean? And so you have to be able to communicate that. And so the thing I learned in meetings, sitting through endless meetings talking about bills and programs and policy, was let's take that and translate it so the people I used to call the mythical Herb and Ethel. I had a fellow who mentored me for many years, Bill O'Connell, the late political editor for the Peoria Journal Star, who had another couple. And he thought, if I could write so when they picked the paper up in the morning or in the afternoon, and they'd understand what the program was about, and you could leave all the acronyms and nomenclature off to the side and say, okay, this family's going to get an extra $50 because the Social Security inflation index, the COLA,
right?
It's what inflation is bringing is going to give you some more money. By the way, I think we both get more than 79. I was sitting in the parking lot listening.
I did the math last night. I was like, no, come on now.
Yeah.
Now, and it's an interesting thing because when you're talking about with journalists, and you outline it was a small, I will call it for lack of a better word, a confrontation between you and a member of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Well, you did read this thing in detail.
And that, you know, that he, you know, says, I can't believe you're not answering my questions.
Right.
All right. So that's some things because people answer questions and you try, right? But there's a quote. I think it's particularly relevant in today's media world where we scream over one another, where you say yelling louder than others never really worked. No amount of media shouting caused me to provide more information, which I interpreted as bullying. I'll yell at you till you get it.
Right.
But you see this done in almost every format on every side now.
Sure. And for years, and I would point to my friends in the broadcast world, especially in Chicago, who would be in a very competitive situation, even in recent years, and come to a press conference and thought, they had to yell their questions louder than their colleagues. That way, they'd get the attention. Maybe they'd get the question person being asked the question to look their way, so the sound bite, the film clip would look better. And one of the things Mike Madigan did well, I always thought, was he didn't change his answer from question to question, even though it might have gotten louder, might have been phrased a little differently. He had points he wanted to make and would make them. That always wasn't the most popular, but it was a way to make sure you didn't get off message, as we like to euphemistically say.
I find it interesting because I found it easier even in myself based on now seeing where I am and looking back and seeing how that happened, because somebody had that effect on me when I was young. And in particular, you say getting your foot in the front door, you talk about my path as a St. Louis Catholic boys' school to Southern Illinois University. And there's times where it seems where those, that part of your youth re-manifest themselves. And in particular, I noticed this, and you were saying the invincibility speaker, Madigan, greatly created by media outlets looking for a shortcut to better define him. We're going to talk more about that in just a couple of moments. But you go on to say in this very same portion that, you know, using terms like veto-proof and supermajority were phrases never used by me. It seems boastful and unnecessary. It was the kind of language that only set someone up to fall when the time would come and the seas did not open. Seas did not open is one reference. But this, in my definition, in my personal vocabulary, is live by the sword, die by the sword.
Oh, sure. And as soon as you start, especially this, the whole, you know, how big is how many Democrats are in the Illinois House thing, as soon as you start to talk about that, you're expected to win every time, you know, regardless of what the issue is. And that doesn't always happen. And it doesn't happen, I know, with Democrats. Sometimes it doesn't even happen with Republicans, who I think are much better marching in lockstep on topics. But Democrats can do the same in certain instances.
And, you know, and I found this pretty interesting because with all the stress that goes on you and the work that you do, you always struck me as being very calm, very premeditated in your actions. You're not impulsive in nature. And you, in portion to here, I wrote the Zen attitude of Steve Brown is what I was looking at in a section called Setting the Public Policy Agenda. You know, the media is involved in some aspects of the formation of the public policy. The media will focus attention on its initial development, follow up with expert opinion, waxing on, I believe, the solutions I'm looking for there. We can edit this later. An opposing opinion will get attention to. A solution could evolve, or the attention wanes and the topic will drift away. That is a loaded statement in my mind. Very important items that we feed on, and then suddenly they just evaporate.
Sure, and because something else with more pizzazz, maybe more images, comes across to everybody's attention or happens in a region, and that we don't even remember, what went on, I mean, I was asking some people, like I said, I've been here all week, what if there was any follow-up, because I hadn't seen reporting on, I think it's Kenesha Jackson, the freshman who died at the house party, tragically.
Right.
Everybody said, gee, I don't, you know, and these were people kind of around the journalism program. I won't say reporters at the Daily Egyptian or anywhere else. And they said, no, there were reports of a lot of, you know, that she was, the party she was at, there were three others shot. It appears to be just some mope driving by with a gun and extra bullets to waste, which is, I mean, it's a tragic, tragic situation. But nobody, and now I read early, in the middle of the week, there was a report that there was an increased
$10,000
reward going out,
and
the FBI is getting involved, which could, you know, could help turn over some new information. But, you know, what a tragic situation, what a terrible image it really has, because you send your kids away to school, you know, and then you come to a town. You know, my boys are now in grad school here, but they can't extricate themselves from Carbondale. And you think, okay, was it, she went to the wrong place at the wrong time, obviously, but was it there, she was in a terrible situation, terrible area? No. I mean, she was just a few blocks off campus.
Right.
My boys had that frat house on Mill Street. I think Cherry was only a couple blocks away. And holy cow.
By the way, we're still working that story. And if you stick around in about 25 minutes, the Carbondale Police Chief, Dan Reno, is coming to meet me on that issue today at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Because I'm keeping working on this story because I see the importance, just as you spoke it a couple of moments ago. You brought up my Madigan.
Yes.
Most powerful label has a touch of urban legend. The invincibility of Speaker Madigan, generally created by media outlets looking for a shortcut to better define him for the reading, listener, viewing audience. And it was interesting because you say, look, a lot of this has been manufactured by the media, while at the same time saying this guy knew how to work. When people asked him for help and they were rank and file members, Mike Madigan helped them, and that helped them with their reelection.
Right.
And you didn't mince words about this, Steve. You said this is what was done. This is how it was done.
Sure. And it didn't necessarily, I didn't, some people would think that's, oh, is that proper? And I think, isn't that part of the reason, maybe a big part of the reason, maybe the biggest reason you send somebody to the state legislature, a city council, a township board, I mean, heck, the park district board in your town. You see something that needs to be done, you go to Representative X and say, can you do this? And Representative X applies himself and finds, you know, supporters and allies, and you get it done. And Madigan's attitude is, if I can help those people, the rank and file member, get things done, then I've done my job. They'll probably continue to support me. We may be able to band together to get bigger things, statewide issues, take them on and accomplish it. You know, and that was just the way the whole thing worked. Now, occasionally, we came up short, you know, and I talk about
tax increase.
Well, tax increase. Although Mike Madigan in the House passed what we call the millionaire's tax, and I don't want to get into a debate and a who's right, who's wrong over that and the fair tax, but it always struck me, if you used the term that you wanted it to apply to pretty rich people, and I'm not sure where you and I,
rich and wealthy,
you and I would be striving to become eligible to pay it. That's how I always said. People say, well, what about this? I said, well, I'd love to be eligible, but I don't have that kind of income, you know? And you may feel the same way. And that's how he did it. We got it through the House. We didn't get it through the Senate. We never got it to a referendum question. The fair tax did. And unfortunately, a lot of stuff got used against it.
Yeah, he says if he could help them address the problems, it generally ease the headaches of re-election.
Yeah.
Is your career defined by the relationship with Mike Madigan? Because when I read your history, and here's one of the reasons why, Jane Byrne, and the fact that you help and your organization helps a lot of other people who aren't Mike Madigan.
It has, and the years with the city of Chicago, Tom, I came there because I had just been turned down by the Tribune, saying I'd never be good enough to be a reporter at the Tribune. And some friends of mine had worked in the Byrne campaign in 79. They said, hey, we'll have opportunities at City Hall. And I said, you know, I've never lived in Chicago. We can teach you all what you need to know about Chicago and what the issues are about. But you do know something about Springfield, how the legislature works, and, you know, represent the mayor. And I was started out as sort of just a messenger from the mayor's office to the leadership to people like Mike Madigan and Bill Redman and Phil Rock in the Senate and others. And then I tried to work very closely with Chicago Democratic legislators who helped me because I could then kind of break down some of the barriers in the City Hall for them. And it was, a pretty decent process. It's how I got to know Madigan and led to 38 years of working for him.
All right. Relationships are how things get done. And it doesn't matter where you're in politics, you need transmission done on your car.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Do we have a tendency, when I say we, journalists, writers, newspapers, to take, when the politicians do it, it's a conspiracy?
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder.
Yeah. When a reporter honestly says, gee, you know, my wife is looking for, I'd like to go to work, and she does this and this and this, and this and this and this fits into a place in the government, and can you pick up a phone and make a call to somebody and help them? You're not asking the reporter to do anything. You're not asking the spouse to go do anything. That happens. I don't think it's, and they come in and do a day's work for a day's pay. And they're not looking like, okay, we're going to get a check, but we're never going to show up.
This was something you were involved in earlier in your career.
Yeah.
Of this type of thing going on and people not showing up. You worked on some of that, some investigative reporting or something like that?
I did some of that. Yeah. And yes. And so, but when they, if you just help them and they go and do an honest day's work, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And you're not necessarily taking anything away from anybody else to do it. So,
who would you want people to know that you worked for that they don't know you did work for? I saw a lot of interesting things.
Well, there was the Jane, and then I take pride, and I've just talked about this in a class earlier this week, was helpful in the last probably 2 months of Carol Braun's campaign for the U.S. Senate. I'd known Carol when she was in the legislature. She went on to a county job, then became part of a three-way primary after Alan Dixon, contentious three-way primary, after Alan Dixon voted to confirm Clarence Thomas to the court. And there was a third person, a lawyer who had some wealth, who spent a lot on television. Carol kind of moved, you know, through life with a grace and a smile that made her extremely popular. And the lawyer tore Alan down pretty well, unfortunately. Alan didn't do much, really, to defend himself, or maybe even say, maybe I shouldn't have been for Clarence Thomas, but that'll be in his legacy. And Carol became the nominee against Rich Williamson, who was a smart guy who had worked for a congressman. I had known Rich when he was a congressional staffer as a reporter, and got called in because there were some bumps in the road in the final weeks of that general election.
I remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was one of the bumps.
Okay. Yeah, well, that'll happen. And so,
well, it was that top 10 list of how to know if you were from Southern Illinois. Remember
what?
That?
Yeah.
I wrote a top 10 list of how to know if you're a senator from Chicago.
Okay.
So good times all the way around.
Sure. And so one, I had to try and get the campaign on track, and I tried then to make sure she could go through the last few weeks of the campaign not setting off new landmines. And we accomplished that.
And this is something...
And I was proud of that. And
you've talked about this, and it appears thematically, if you know, that there comes a point where you just keep your mouth shut.
Smile.
Right? You talk about this.
She had a great smile.
You talk about this even the last session over the last year of there's nothing more to say, so why go out there and just keep saying it? Don't just keep your mouth shut.
Because inevitably you'll say something. You'll think I have to say more.
Right.
Even though it's not true.
And then you'll step on your poncho.
Right.
Right? And you go, why did I do that?
And then there'll be a different story.
Right. And another story. Now, I want to talk because we're out of time, but I got to squeeze a couple more minutes in. All right?
Okay. I'll talk faster.
When I look at this book and I read it and I come to an end and know the circumstances in which you have worked, because I've been in the same information, right? You seem to have a level of optimism about journalism, press, and politics that I don't possess.
Okay. Well, and maybe it's naive, maybe it's unrealistic, but I'd like to think where we hallmark now, this division and acrimony, it seems like every step of the way, hopefully that it gets burned out, because I don't see where it's really doing any good, where the sides are just, at each other's throat 24/7 on seemingly every topic. I mean, I, for one, Tom, I'm fully vaccinated. I'm antibody positive. And I've seen so much of the reporting of all these hospital workers, healthcare workers, who are just totally stretched out. And I'm thinking, I don't want to do anything to add to their burden in any place, any way.
Everybody has a reason.
And now, I mean, there's all these different things. Okay, we're not going to report for police duty in Chicago because we don't want to get vaccinated or admit whether we have it or not. I'm sorry, I don't get it. It seems like a simple step. Everybody rushed their kids to get polio vaccines, and when that all happened, and we generally go get flu shots. There you go.
Got my mark.
Okay. Well, I remember the basic training in the Army. They'd roll you through some medical hall, and then they started using the pneumatic.
Right.
They were too cheap to buy needles, right? Or they didn't want to. The guy, you'd flinch, or the guy would miss, and you'd tear a hole inside of your arm. Then you'd have to get, come back for the shot because you were bleeding too bad. So it's been an interesting world. Flattered, I think, or I feel honored at your comments. You've read the whole thing in great detail, because it's 30 plus pages, this version. I enjoyed it. I appreciated John Jackson's invitation and Allie Quick's editing at the Paul Simon Institute. I've enjoyed a good relationship with that organization since day one, when Paul and Mike Lawrence set it up. So I appreciate the ability to talk about it a little bit.
You know, I think I was thrown in this job because they thought I would fail. Well, that didn't work out.
Yeah, I know. Here you're a radio legend,
right? You refer to me as a legend in the book.
Yeah,
and I
got to
tell you, I do appreciate. I don't think I deserve it, but I darn well do appreciate.
Because you can't walk around the region, that's what I've seen, without somebody saying, "Hey, heard you on Tom Miller," or "Hey, did you hear who so and so on Tom Miller?" So that's and especially as now there's so much streaming going on and everything else. And that's how I listen to your station, by the way,
right?
Streaming off of TuneIn Radio all the time. And that's to note it.
Right.
You can deny it or say, no, I'm too humble a guy.
All right. So you've written the book. It gives you a chance to have some introspection.
Yeah.
You look back.
Right.
What's your conclusion? Well, after 50 years... Media's changed. You talk about this when I used to use those old typewriters,
Royal manual typewriters.
My fingers are still bent,
mm-hmm.
because I only had two that I knew how to use.
But then you could just edit it out with a pencil,
right? And edit it out, right?
Yeah.
Right. Before whiteout, but to where you can have news in your pocket 24/7, and then of course the bitter nature of news too. So, what's your conclusion about the state of journalism in Illinois?
Well, it's at a point where you want to do everything you can to help them. The legislature this past session created a local news task force, I think is the term. The governor signed the bill. There'll be appointees from the legislature, from the journalism schools around the state, looking to how do we sustain local news, which I think is very important. I mean, the newspapers, radio stations, do they have the staff to even go to the city council meeting anymore? And it probably means there's going to need to be a pot of money found. That's not so hard. Then there's going to have to be a methodology about distribution that's being grappled with in some other places. I think there's a federal bill as well. But it seems like if we can subsidize so many other kinds of activities in our life, in our society, that's not a bad thing to work on.
Staffing the Illinois Delegation Press operation taught me that the events were heavily covered and devoid of news.
Oh, and conventions. National conventions were the opportunity for Illinois-based journalists to go to whatever remote location. The worst one was, I think, 96, where we were in Chicago, so you're really not going to Chicago. Not as fun as going to New York or Philadelphia or Denver or L.A. And then they were there in mass, spending a lot of their station's dough, and you had to try and find a way to help them fill the time.
Right.
Interviews, and you know, there was occasionally a congressman who would talk about running for the Senate, or a senator willing to talk about running for governor, and chasing that story around, or two members of Congress who might want to run for the Senate, and chasing those stories around helped meet that obligation, filling that news capacity, as I like to talk about.
Steve Brown, can you get this download on the internet?
It is. I sent you an email earlier with the link. It's through OpenSIUC, and it's a whole big raft of letters, numbers, dots, and slashes. So right. Better if you just
search it,
put it on your website or whatever.
Yeah, I'll do that later.
Give it to that internet thing. I think it's going to catch on, Tom. I'm not sure.
It's called Exit Essay, A Reflection on More Than 50 Years of Media Coverage in the Illinois State House, and by Steve Brown. Steve, it's good to talk to you about it. And I love this and the work you did and the frankness of it. My favorite term was substantial math abilities of journalists.
It's a truism.
It's true, too.
Tom, thank you. And I hope you'll have me back somewhere down the road.
There is more that we could talk about this, because I've got a lot more that I didn't even get to today.
Okay.
Right? News Great. Radio WJPF, Your Money Now, brought to you by the UPS Store, behind Pozzoli's Marion, shipping, packing, printing, mailbox services, notary, and fax services.